This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. We've got a wide variety of programming on today. Two interviews going in sort of completely opposite directions, although I imagine they might meet somewhere in the middle. First, I'm going to talk with Gail Green, who is a professor of literature and women's studies at Scripps College in Claremont, California, but who has been working for the past number of years on a impassioned, I would say angry book called Insomniac, about what it's like to suffer, in her case, all her life from insomnia, and how the world of insomnia research and therapy looks. And I'll tell you right at the beginning, it's not very pretty. And then in the second half, I'm going to talk with local bookseller and author James Van Eaton about his new epic fantasy, Down the Darkening Road. But to begin with, Gail Green, I have on the phone line, I hope. Welcome to Booktown.
Thank you.
I was in touch with you a little earlier today, and you said last night was one of those nights.
Yes. If I have a schedule that I can completely control, I can usually, you know, cobble together enough sleep to get by. But I had an early morning engagement this morning, and it left me with 3 hours of sleep, and 3 hours of sleep just doesn't do it for me.
But you did manage to get a bit of a nap.
Yes, since I was at home, I could go back and get about a half an hour nap, so I feel much better.
Now, you've been suffering from insomnia pretty much all your life. I guess that when you were very young, your mother noticed how active you were, how alert, and how little you slept, but she just thought it was your babyish way.
Yeah, yeah. Right, I was impossible to get to sleep. I mean, I wouldn't go to sleep. I wouldn't let go of the day. And then I'd have this surge of 4 a.m. Energy. My poor mother. I mean, she was like a normal sleeper, but it was it wasn't trouble. I mean, it wasn't nightmares or night terrors. It was, she described, well, the reason I know this is she left this wonderful cache of letters for after she died. I found these letters that she had written to my father during World War II when he was away for a year and a half while I was 6 months to 2 years old, and it just told the whole story about, you know, like how, I mean, it was just these incredible details about my, you know, sleep and about my personality. And apparently I was quite a happy, bubbly baby, but I just wouldn't let go of the day. You know?
But at some point, it stopped being bubbly and began being a problem.
Yeah, high school, which is when my memories cut in, I was exhausted. I went through high school in a total haze. I would, you know, not get to sleep until 4 in the morning, and then I'd have to be up at, you know, 6:30, and then I'd slog through the day, and then I would come home and nap, and that was, of course, a bad habit to get into, a bad pattern, and then I'd be up late, and it would just go on and on. I don't know how I got through, but, yeah, a lot of adolescents have this problem. The clock, our circadian clocks shift a little bit later, and teenagers have a terrible time with high school, many of them.
There's so many directions we could go in this with just a little bit you said in the first 2 minutes, but one point that you bring up again and again and again in your book Insomniac is the effect that seems very clear to you of hormones and hormonal changes on sleep patterns. But you say this is something, and this is the big point in your book, that sleep researchers pay almost no attention to.
Well, the sleep researchers do pay attention to that. They are now beginning to be become interested in, now that some women have entered the field. I think the men were not terribly interested in hormones, but the women researchers are good at that. It's the insomnia. It's the doctors, the clinicians, who don't really have, seem to be very sort of, you know, they just don't want to hear about it. A woman comes in and she says, well, I think it's my hormones. The doctor will say, well, here, why don't you try an antidepressant? No, I really think it's, you know, just before I get my period, or I think it's now that I'm going into menopause. Well, why don't you try an antidepressant? I mean, there's just a real lack of feeling about that. But the researchers themselves are turning up just amazing things that a lack of sleep does to hormones, for one thing, and also the way women's hormones impact, make for real sleep disruption.
So as a teenager, you began to suffer greatly. I guess the first 9-to-5 job you tried to hold down in publishing, you couldn't, and you finally settled in teaching, which offers you some relief.
I was very lucky. I mean, because in teaching, you can schedule late afternoon class and evening classes, and I can do the work on my own time. I have a late clock. I think I was born with that one. And a lot of, you know, people who are lucky find their ways to, you know, jobs where they can structure their own time, freelance work, entertainment. I don't know. There's lots of kind of places for insomniacs to go. But if you get caught in a 9-to-5 world with this affliction, it is a horror show. And you can see that on the web. You go on the insomnia chat rooms, and people are just having such a hard time dealing with it.
Yeah, you actually sound pretty upbeat and as if you've managed to come to terms with it. But reading your book, I would say it's a very angry book.
Would you say that? That's interesting. I thought I'd toned it down a bit.
No, okay.
You have to, at some point, just resign yourself to it. This is who I am, and try to put it in perspective. There are people who have so many worse things happen to them than this. You know, I'm ambulatory. I'm out in the world. I actually have managed to have a career. So I hope I've, you know, so it's just something I live around, you know, like, you know, when I have an early morning engagement, it's a horrible day. But other than that, people know not to kind of count on me before noon, and not to call me before noon. You know, as I say, I'm lucky. I'm an academic, and I've been able to do that. But people do, I mean, many of the people I interview, I mean, they do find their own way with it. They find a way to live with it. They don't stay kind of tied up in knots. Some of them go kind of mystical routes, alternative medicine, you know, and others just retire.
Now, you, when I a minute ago brought up the research into hormones, you said it is right now going fairly well.
Mm-hmm.
But when you first started dealing with doctors on this question and brought up things like hormones, you got essentially totally ignored. People seemed to think that insomniacs, there was something basically wrong with them, that they were malingerers or they had some sort of mental problem, and the insomnia came from that rather than the other way around.
You know, you would still get, I think I would still get that treatment from a doctor if I went into his office, you know, his or her office with a problem today. I think I would definitely, I mean, there's a difference between the state of clinical, you know, what you get, the treatments you get from a doctor, and the state of research, what's being talked about at the sleep meetings and in the literature, where they are becoming much more enlightened, but it's going to take a long time for that to filter down to doctors. Doctors actually don't get very much instruction in sleep in medical school. They're pretty unknowledgeable about sleep. So they would still give you this knee-jerk, it's all in your head, it must be a psychological problem where you're really too stressed out, and you must be depressed. And I say, well, you know, actually, I'm not depressed except about my sleep. You know, and my life may be stressful, but I know so many people who lead lives that are so much more stressful and sleep fine. You know, it's so what the research, sorry, losing my voice here. What the research at the meetings has taught me is that insomnia is, there is a physiological disposition to it. The sleep system is a physiological system. You know, we share it with all the animals, do it. And sleep behaviors are inborn and genetic, whether we are morning people or evening people or short sleepers or long sleepers. That comes with our neurobiological territory. There's not a whole lot we can do about it. So the indication is that at some point, they will understand the physiological disposition to fragile sleep. They call it fragile sleep, you know, a lot of them do anyway, as opposed to, like, robust sleep. You know, we all know those people who, they're out like a light, they can sleep through anything, they can have a double espresso after dinner and flake out. They're now beginning to understand why, you know, what it is about those people that enables that to happen. Very interesting. So, you know, one day there will be a breakthrough that, this is the neurotransmitter that's there is too little of, you know.
Now, you point out that there have been insomniacs as long as there's been recorded history, but that our sleep patterns seem to have radically changed in the last 150 or 200 years.
Yeah, I think that I think the modern world makes more insomniacs than there were in the past, because in the past, people actually had more flexible sleep, a little bit more like mine. You know, they didn't have to be on the job at 9, you know, from 9 to 5. And there's evidence that before electricity and before industrialization, people slept in two segments. And there was a long kind of space in between. Well, that describes the, you know, sleep pattern of a lot of insomniacs. Only what happens with us in this world is we get upset about it, you know, because, oh my God, the alarm's going off in 3 hours and I got to be on the freeway. They didn't, you know. And also, if you go to other cultures, traditional cultures, they are much more, there's a tendency to napping during the day, napping in public places, kind of dropping off where and when you're sleepy and staying up as late as there's something interesting going on. And, of course, there's, you know, entire cultures that have been organized around the siesta, midday siesta. So sleep is, it's malleable to some extent, culturally, you know, kind of constructed. On the other hand, well, you know, you just, again, you know, if you're lucky enough, you can find a pattern of your own that will work.
But it seems like the only way doctors really come to or will be able to understand individuals' sleep patterns is to really get to know the patients very well, find out a lot about their lives, what makes them tick, what works here,
wouldn't
what works there.
Nice?
And we seem to be going in exactly the opposite direction.
That is the sad fact about all chronic conditions. You know, chronic conditions are lifelong, built up over life, very deeply embedded in a person's, you know, who they are and how they live. And you don't find out anything about that in 7 minutes, which is the average length I read recently of a physician visit. Now, and of course, the, you know, tendency is to push patients through faster and faster and faster. So for chronic conditions, we really have to go elsewhere for help for this.
I said before that this was an angry book in many ways, and among the people you seem to, or institutions you seem to be angry at, in some, and I think quite justifiably, are the whole health system that gives us only 7 minutes per doctor's visit. Also, though, the massive pressure from the pharmaceutical industry, and that seems to particularly have had a bad influence on insomniacs.
Let me just go back to the doctors for a minute, because I have to say I'm not anti-doctor at all. I mean, my father was a doctor. He was a very one of those heroic doctors. And I think doctors are caught in the system as much as patients are. It looks like they're the enemy, or they're the person who's doing 7 minutes. But in fact, when you read about how doctors feel about their professions, they feel pretty, many of them feel pretty awful about it, you know, that the only thing they can do in 7 minutes is pretty much write a prescription, and the good ones are, you know, quite torn about that, I think. But, the pharmaceutical companies are, oh, they're so rich. I mean, the money, their, you know, pocket change could, like, float empires. It's amazing. And they're so influential. They do determine often which drugs doctors prescribe, and doctors don't always realize that they're doing this, but I mean, the person who, you know, paid their vacation and they had these really nice lectures and they had a lot of free samples, you know, and then you find the doctor is prescribing that drug for you, and it may or may not be the best drug for you. So it's being prescribed for interests other than, you know, having determined the patient's best interests, and that's pretty pernicious. Also, they don't take big risks, these drug companies. They tend to keep inventing, you know, reinventing the same drug, and so everybody says, you know, well, why isn't there a better, why aren't there some new approaches? And well, they tend to be pretty conservative, the big drug companies. There are now some new approaches in the pipeline that I am looking forward to, you know, seeing what they come up with.
And you point out that again and again and again, classes of drugs have come along that seem to be wonder cures, and not only that, were non-addictive, and turned out not to be wonder cures, and turned out to be highly addictive.
Yeah, that is a sad fact about the history of these. This development is that, you know, every drug that comes along is pronounced to be the best, you know, the new, the wonder drug. It's, you know, it gives natural sleep, it's not addictive, you know, no problem, no problem. And then every one of these drugs, you know, Valium turned out to be problematic. Well, first of all, the barbiturates back in the early 20th century were said to be perfectly safe and natural, and of course they turned out to be very dangerous and highly addictive. And then along came the benzodiazepines like Valium and Ativan, and the same story. They are not, however, as bad as barbiturates. So, and then along came the non-benzodiazepines, Ambien, and that was said to be perfectly wonderful. And of course, we see that people are having a lot of problems with Ambien. But I have to also say that each of those drug categories is better than the category before. I mean, and I'm very glad to be alive in the age of Ambien and not, you know, the age of those barbiturates when, you know, people were overdosing and becoming just stupid with Marilyn Monroe, it was said, could not memorize her lines in her last film, The Misfits. I mean, she must have just felt so horrible. They're all problematic, and yet they are now currently better than they were 100 years ago or even 50 years ago. And I'm hoping they'll still get better. They'll get better yet. The more they understand about the sleep system, the more precisely they'll be able to target, you know, what's specifically wrong with us.
And you point out in very great detail the specific drugs you have used, what benefits they've had, what side effects they've had, which ones you've gotten addicted to in ways you didn't want, and how you finally managed to have it sort of under control so that if you absolutely need one, you can take it. Mm-hmm. But if you prefer not to.
Yeah, yeah. You really have to learn to manage your drugs. I mean, first of all, you have to figure out which drug works best for you, because you can't try. Well, because the doctor can't really know that for you. Only you can find out by trial and error which drug is best. I mean, you know, he may have his favorite and may have nothing to do with anything that works on you. So you have to try around, first of all, to find something, find out how it works, how long it puts you to sleep, how much time you have to leave in the morning to get functional again. And then having found something that you like, you have to keep it within bounds. You know, you have to monitor your own responses. I mean, this Ambien weirdness, I think it must have been people kind of not paying attention, you know, to what the drug was, you know, the sleep eating, the sleep driving. God, that's so terrifying. I've never had anything like that with Ambien. I've taken a lot of it. But I really try to keep it within bounds, keep it to the second half of the sleep, try to get sleep of my own, take only a little bit for the second half, and then I can make it work over a long period of time without, you know, cumulative grogginess. Because they do tend to build up, you know, and you get used to them and you end up taking up more to get the same effect. They're a real, it's like having a bear by the nose taking drugs, and yet I frankly don't think I could have, you know, had a career, had a life without them.
You've spent all your life tackling with this problem and not being taken seriously by the doctors or researchers who you questioned. You have really three models, I guess, who have kept you going. One is the British doctor, Alice Stewart, back in the 50s. Can you tell us a bit about her?
Oh, she was so wonderful. She found out, I wrote her biography, Alice Stewart, and the secrets of radiation. The woman who knew too much. She found out in the 50s that if you X-ray pregnant women, you double the chance of a childhood cancer. And it took 20 years before, you know, anybody believed her. I mean, they tried to not, you know, pay attention to her, try to shoot her down because it was not a popular discovery. Nobody wanted to know that radiation was that dangerous. And doctors were X-raying like crazy in those days. They were, you know, doing these fetal X-rays. They were using X-rays, you know, very irresponsibly. They didn't know the dangers, but they didn't want to hear the dangers. So it was really a long haul for her, and she dug in her, you know, heels and really proved, you know, gave proof positive that this was a dangerous thing. And she was a hero to me because she hung in with her positions against, you know, all the authorities who were just, and she, in the end, she was proved right, and doctors have stopped, you know, that practice. The first thing that you're asked now when you go in for an X-ray is there any chance you could be pregnant? And that's because of her findings. I mean, think how many cancers she spared the human race. It was a wonderful story, and she taught me a lot about science. I mean, I worked with her for 5 years. She was British. I'd go to, she was outside Oxford. It was a beautiful place where she lived, and we would work together, and I just sort of soaked in this, you know, first-rate scientific. She was an physician and then an epidemiologist, and she died in 2003, so I hadn't started this book, but I always felt like she was accompanying me on the book because she's the one who gave me the courage to kind of, well, to go into science this deeply, but also to kind of hang in there.
How long did you hang in? How long, you must have proposed this book to UC Press, or did you start it on your own without a contract?
I started on my own, yeah, without a contract, and it was a six-year process. It was a very long, long haul, and it was six intensive years. I mean, I was really at it.
And at what point did you know you were going to get it published?
Well, early on, the editor about midway through it, I'd say, the editor at UC Press saw something an article I'd written about insomnia, and she was very interested in it for personal reasons. And she, you know, she just kind of wrote me and said, do you want to, let's talk, you know, and we did, and she's been a fabulous editor, so.
The other two groups that I think inspired you said, who are actually suffer, there are fewer of people suffering from these maladies than from insomnia, but the people who do suffer from restless leg syndrome and narcolepsy got organized earlier than insomniacs and seem to have had quite an effect.
You know, they really have. The restless legs group, that was started by people who were quite on in years, in their 80s, and one of them, I think, was in his 90s. And they, you know, also had been told, you know, restless legs is this irresistible kind of desire to move the legs when you rest, and it's a real torment. And then narcolepsy is when the patient, when the person just nods off all the time during the day. They seem to be dopey and tired and sleepy and don't have the energy for anything. So these, both of these conditions were said to be psychological, psychosomatic. Oh, these people must be nuts. You know, they must be avoiding their life or restless legs. Well, you know, there's nothing making you, I mean, there's nothing we can see that's wrong with you, so what's the problem? So again, you know, it's like they had to say, wait a minute, this is not my head, this isn't my body, something is wrong with me, and, you know, I want you to do some research. And one of, I think it was the restless legs people, the restless legs people went, they made their own questionnaire, and they then took their results to a doctor, and he wrote, you know, he actually, a researcher who was able to do something, tabulate, do some statistical analysis of what they come in with, and by God, they were right. You know, there was this, it was a condition that came on much earlier than was said, and I don't know, it was inspiring. It was this kind of shoe leather epidemiology, you know, where the patients go out and start gathering information, and then the researchers, you know, can actually use it, and I would so much like to see that happen with insomnia. I'd like to see us, get-together. I hope that my site, sleepstarve.org, is the name of my website, and it's under construction. It's not in final form now, but it's if people would leave comments and tell their stories, and, you know, this is how we can get new information, and then, you know, devise a questionnaire at some point in the future where people can, you know, where we can actually take something to the researchers and say, hey, look at this, you know, this is what we know about the condition.
But even after the success of the restless leg and narcolepsy people, when you wanted to go to sleep conferences, you kept getting turned down.
Well, I know that, you know, they didn't turn me down for the conferences. They sort of pretty much had to take me for that. They're open to the public. But I did get turned down for a lot of interviews. There were a lot of people who didn't want to talk to me. I don't know. I guess I had some strikes against me. I was, writer. They think, ooh, press, you know, media. We don't know what she's going to do with us, you know. Woman, I think this is still a pretty patriarchal world. And a non-scientist, you know, I was in the humanities. They kind of looked at me like I was one of the laboratory animals, you know, loose in the banquet hall or something. Like, what? You know, I mean, I got a lot of strange stares, and I got a lot of, I encountered more rudeness than I expected. I mean, I was used to going to Modern Language Association conferences or Shakespeare Association conferences where I'd published and I was known and was treated with a lot of respect. And so I had to, like, go back and become a total beginner in this thing. And it was not a world that was welcoming to outsiders, although there were some wonderful people I met in it. I should say there were people who were very welcoming and very generous with their time. But it was kind of the general feel of it was chilly.
Even though you had worked with Alice Stewart and had, you know, probably as good scientific credentials as many beginning researchers, they still didn't take you seriously.
Yeah, well, I couldn't exactly flash that credential on my name tag, you know, and say, hey, look, I've done something in science. And anyway, radiation epidemiology is kind of, you know, the sciences are so specialized that one field doesn't really lap, you know, fold over into another. I should say, can I go back to the narcolepsy and restless legs? What those groups have going for them now is that there have been major breakthroughs in the narcolepsy and restless legs. The researchers have actually found what is wrong in the brain, you know, to make their problem. And so now they've got a lot of ammunition and a lot of power because they can say, look, it's physiological, it's not psychological. Insomniacs don't have that yet, and that's what we need. Desperately, that kind of breakthrough.
Well, your book has just come out. Do you think, are there any signs that it might be the beginning of that breakthrough?
Oh, I hope so. I mean, that's why I spent 6 years writing it. I mean, I just hope it, first of all, you know, raises consciousness in and among insomniacs so we can feel, look, you know, it's not something I'm doing wrong. It's not because I'm neurotic or, you know, psychopathological. It's a physical problem. And so I can talk about it to other people. I don't need to have the shame and the stigma about it. So I can go public with it. And then I hope we can get the attention of the world, you know, employers, so that they'll be more tolerant, so that we can do work on our own time more, so that people don't have to be fired from their 9-to-5 jobs. It's a horrible problem in the workplace for an insomniac. And then get the attention of researchers. Hey, you know, do the kind of research that's going to lead to this kind of breakthrough that the narcolepsy and the restless legs syndrome has had.
Although it looks like right now as if that the budgets for that sort of research are being cut back.
You know, that is horrible. You know, NIH has been frozen, has been cut, and all these wonderful, worthwhile projects, and I hear about them in sleep all the time, that are just being terminated. And, well, there goes the hope of ever finding that gene, you know, that kind of thing. The trouble is that insomnia is not perceived as life-threatening. You know, so let's give the money, you know, very limited resources. The money will go to the life threat, you know, cancer and the really, you know, things that patient more obviously kill people faster than insomnia does. But insomnia, it's an invisible disability. You don't see what it's doing to people. And it's going to wallop the healthcare system. we're a real drain on the healthcare system. Insomniacs have more hospitalizations. We have more accidents on the road, on the job. We're just a kind of sicker kind of people. And also, sleep gets worse with age, and we are an aging population. And so, you know, it makes us more likely to end our days in a nursing home than on our own, less able to live on our own. So policymakers should be aware that this is a problem, and it's going to get worse with as our population ages.
Your book has just come out, and the blurbs on the back, two of them, interestingly enough, are from writers, insomniac writers, Joyce Carol Oates and Billy Collins. The other four are from sleep researchers who you actually write about pretty sympathetically in the book. They're obviously the ones who are moving in the direction you'd like them to move. Mm-hmm. Have you, even though it's so, the book's just come out, do you have any indication that it might be getting an effect on other people?
Not yet, no. There were a couple of sleep researchers who wrote me and said how much they liked it, you know, that they really appreciate it, and they thought it would, you know, be good for the field. There were people I had met, so I don't know. I'm a little afraid of what some of the others will say. I hope nobody takes it as a personal attack. It's not. I would like to see, you know, there are not very many insomnia researchers. The researchers who do the neurobiological, looking at the brain in terms of insomnia. And I would just want to say, go into that area. I mean, that is an area where we really need help. It's a very difficult area. I understand why people want to work more on apnea than they want to work on insomnia. Apnea is much simpler.
And more lucrative.
Well, yeah, it certainly is that.
That's one of the scathing parts of the books. If I had to pick out scathing parts of the book, there's probably at least 30. And we've probably touched on about 6 or 7. And I'm afraid that's all the time we have for right now.
Uh-huh.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I've been talking with Gail Green, who's a professor of literature, especially Shakespearean studies and of women's studies at Scripps College, but has been working for the past 6 years on her book Insomniac, which has just been published by the University of California Press. So thanks so much for being with us, and I hope it has a big impact.
Thank you very much.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I'll be with you till 2 p.m. And in the second half of the program, I have a person who I would bet quite a few of our listeners have seen around without necessarily knowing who they were talking to or what exactly he's been up to in the rest of his life. His name is James Van Eaton, and for a number of years, I guess 5.5 years?
Yeah, 5.5.
He was frequently known to people in the local book trade as James from Ames. He would call other book dealers saying, "This is James from Ames, and I'm looking for a book," or we would call him to see if they had a book for a particular customer. And I'm sure anybody who went into Ames probably couldn't have missed James, because he's, what, 6'6"?
Yeah, about that.
About that. And in the last couple of years, you've been running your own bookstore down in Auburn.
Yeah, Winston Smith Books down in Auburn. Sort of the same philosophy as Ames, but a little lighter, a little brighter, and a little less cluttered.
Okay. By same philosophy as Ames, you mean to get as much in there as possible?
No, just across the board, all sorts of fiction, all sorts of history and art and drama, just bringing culture to the community.
And it's named, I imagine, most readers would know that Winston Smith is the hero of 1984. And if you didn't, you do now. And if you ever go in there, keep that in mind. In addition to selling books. You've been reading, obviously, for many years, and I went to the Amazon site where you're a reviewer. They have 35 of your reviews there, which are none of which are very long, but are incisive and have gotten some of them have gotten some good comments from other readers who either agree or disagree with you. The majority of the books you review are fantasy or science fiction, and that's clearly your love, and that's the love that you've transferred into your first novel.
It is, yeah. I read a lot of it, and I'm fairly critical of it. In fact, the reason that I'm a little surprised I ended up writing a fantasy novel, I always thought I'd end up in horror, actually, and there's not very much of that in here. But I've been reading speculative fiction or imaginative literature, as Harlan Ellison seems to call it, for a long time, and many of my favorite books are in that genre. But there's also so much junk, so much that has no theme, that has no real characters, black and white, villains and heroes. And I wanted to do something different. I wanted to have a story with people that spoke like real people do, that have proper motivations, that aren't just moved around as the plot would have them go, question what's going on in authority and make their own decisions and have that affect the outcome of the story.
Now, it's described on the back. The book, by the way, is called Down the Darkening Road. It's published by iUniverse, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But you at the beginning, it says, enlisted for various reasons into an uncertain pilgrimage to revive a dead god. Four people of varied backgrounds trust their fates to the gods, one remaining priestess, and set off across a land being torn apart by racial tension and magical prejudice. Well, there's actually eight of them at the beginning. Do only four of them make it to the end?
Well, I think that would be giving something away.
Oh, okay.
Four main characters, I suppose you could say, and there are a few that come in and go out during the process, during the pilgrimage of the mission. There's quite a cast of characters. A lot of another problem I have with commercial generic fantasy is that they have this group of people that are together for no reason at all, and they start them out in some roadside tavern or some castle somewhere, I did a castle, but and they just sort of get together and stay there in this cohesive group, and there's no real reason for them to do so other than the fact that the author needs them to. And this book has a kind of a different take on that. There's a real reason, evolving reason, that they keep going and going. Or do they? I guess that's the question.
And I'll have to admit that this book came to me just last week, and I did not have a chance to read all the way through. And so far, I'm not sure what the reason is. And the characters, the narrator at the beginning, is so far unnamed. Does he remain unnamed, all three?
They do say his name once, actually, in the very beginning. But I did that on purpose because I wanted people to be in his shoes. His name is Shakar, but they say it once. In fact, Stallone says it once. But it never comes up again in the entire book. And it just seemed an interesting device, a way to get the people to really kind of sit in his seat, look through his eyes, and see this world. Because though he's part of this pilgrimage, he really is. He's the main. He's the narrator. He's the one that... kind of looks at all the rest of these people as they do a little bit more, and you get his sardonic sense of humor, and you get his outlook from where he's come from.
He tells the story in four nightly episodes.
Right.
And he's easily the shadiest character of the four. He's basically a pickpocket.
Yeah, a fairly inept thief that never gets that much better, but thinks he's pretty good.
The world that they live in is a world that has suffered two major invasions and the death of its earlier gods. What led you to create that sort of place?
Actually, it's a fairly complicated backstory there. I was taking a creative writing class through Sierra College, and we were studying the social experiments that Stanley Milgram did in the 60s involving how far people would go under the perceived demand of an authority figure, a faceless authority figure. And that's sort of, I suppose, the theme of the book is how far people will go under this simple command, and when they start questioning, and who starts questioning, what they start asking. And I think I just completely lost my train of thought there.
Okay, well, I'll get you back to it in a little bit, because one of the first episodes in Plainstown is where there's really a clash of these four and or eight pilgrims come across a town where everybody is completely in the thrall of authority, mm-hmm. or seems to be, but they manage to break them free.
Right, the prejudicial aspect, or the tolerance issue. I can't seem to write anything without putting in tolerance issues and lessons. It's something that's really important to me. One of my favorite autobiography ever is Richard Wright's Black Boy. I've read a lot of things with people under duress, governments, or just fiction where people are being oppressed. Their creativity is being oppressed. Their spirit. And it's always interesting to me how people react under pressure. Prison stories interest me because they're just broken down into the most simple form of, you put these people in the environment and say they have to do one thing and see how they live, what their existence is like, and really boils down, I guess, the human spirit, if you want to call it that.
Many authors in the beginnings of their books will always say this is, even you do say it. I'll read it. This is a work of fiction. All of the characters, names, incidents, organizations, and dialogue in this novel are either the products of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously. But then your dedication is to four friends, and you say them, without them, the characters of Constance, Sojourn, Shakar, and DeSetzo would not be what they are. You don't mind basing your characters to some degree on your friends, and you don't mind letting them know.
No, I think I'm just being a little more candid with that than some people. When Steinbeck wrote Cannery Row and Sweet Thursday, Ed Ricketts was clearly the model for Doc, and Kerouac for On the Road, used Neil Cassady for Dean Moriarty. And as those two characters are among my favorites in all of fiction, it seemed like a way to go. It seemed like a way to imbue these characters with the personalities of people that you know very, very well. They, in writers' workshops and things, they always say, do diagrams for your characters have histories, have what would their favorite movie would be, what their favorite color. And this is a sort of way of jumping that process a little bit, because I've known most of these people for about 10 years, and Kieran, who Kyrie is loosely based on, for about 4 or 5. And you get in your head what they would say, how they would react, and it makes the story flow, and it gives the characters a greater sense of believability, I hope.
And they don't mind having been put into conditions where they have to deal with arbitrary authority?
Not so far. We'll see. I don't know. I haven't had anybody knocking at my door in the middle of the night yet. Some of them haven't. They've read some very rough drafts, and I don't know if they made it all the way through, but now that the book is out, they better read it.
You published it through iUniverse, which is I wouldn't say a self-publishing company, because right. They do so much for you.
Right.
But it's a company where they will pretty much take what you offer them.
Mm-hmm. Print on demand, which is the nicer way of saying vanity press these days. I've been very happy with iUniverse. They did a fantastic cover for me based on a couple pages. I sent them a lot of description of what I wanted. The formatting was great, and you can do all sorts of things. It just kind of costs you more editing and things like that. But print on demand is really the way to go. Whereas 10 years ago, Vanity Press, you had to pay about $10,000 and order 5,000 copies of your book and have them sitting in a garage. This way you can do about 100, 200, and it's a flat fee at the beginning. And actually, while we're on the subject of Vanity Press real quick, this is something I've had to kind of overcome, because a lot of, I'd say 99% of self-published books and fantasy books in particular, people don't put a lot into them. It's just things that they want to show their friends, and really trying to overcome that stigma that self-published fantasy novels have. This is not just a serialized Dungeons and Dragons campaign. It's there's themes, there's tone, there's atmosphere, there's characters, believability. Good dialogue, I hope. I've been very happy. It's just a bit of a thing to overcome. Tried to write the great book, and
when you do have it printed on demand. How do you go about placing it with booksellers or online?
They do a lot of the online for you. It's part of the purchase package. That sounds so ridiculously commercial. It's part of the package, and they will procure you a spot with Amazon.com, which is the main one, arguably, who is also Borders.com now, BarnesandNoble.com, Target.com. And what it seems to me is that if they begin selling well online, then some of those brick and mortar stores, Barnes and Noble, will actually begin to carry it. You can always order it from them. So that's a way to go. And
from iUniverse, you mean?
Well, from iUniverse or from Barnes & Noble. I'm fairly sure if you just go into one of their stores in Roseville and ask them, or the bookseller up here, and they can order it. They should be able to order it.
You're working on another one.
I am. I can't seem to stop.
Cartoon Eyes, which sounds very, very different.
It's very different. Down the Darkening Road is fairly, epic. There's a lot of subplots. There's a lot of people that are not being entirely truthful with each other, and it's a lot to juggle character motivations. Cartoon Eyes was sort of a break. I wanted to do something a little different, a little more linear, a little more fun. Not that the other one's not fun. There's a lot of humor. It's not as dark as the title might suggest. But Cartoon Eyes is geared for about, 10 to 13-year-olds. And it's about a group of kids that get pulled into an anime, into a Japanese cartoon, and turn into caricatures, turn into the beautiful elven princess with the squeaky voice and the ninja that can jump 30 feet in the air and disappears randomly, and makes them kind of take a look at how they are easily classified, and eventually they begin to rebel against that ideal amid shenanigans and battles and things.
Back to Down the Darkening Road, the big problem with being self-published, even with iUniverse helping with the distribution, is how do you go about publicizing it? How do you get the word out?
Well, wonderful radio programs really help. having been doing used bookstores and having these bookstore contacts for the last 9 years, I've had a lot of wonderful people that are going to tell me they're carrying it. I don't have an official date, but it sounds like Booktown Books is going to do some sort of reading, which is very, very generous. So it fortunately places me above some of these other people because I can go to these venues and ask them to carry it or to have a reading. Other than that, it's just a lot of word of mouth. I'm selling a lot of books out of my store to people that a lot of the time don't read fantasy and just want to read my book, which is just crazy gratifying.
You also sell it cheaper there.
I do. It's $17.95. I'm basically cutting all of my cost. I make about $1 when I sell it there, and I will happily sign and inscribe them, which, makes it collectible. I don't know. But I'm doing everything I can to make this a real book. I want to promote the fact that it's not just some kid and working on his little high school daydream. This is for me the hopefully the beginning of a career in fantasy and speculative fiction.
When you go through somebody like iUniverse, you say it's print on demand. Do they print 10 copies at a time, 50 copies at a time, 100?
I believe the minimum is about 50. You, of course, get a greater discount when you go higher. So you try and do as many as you can afford at once. And I did 200 for the first batch, which almost broke me. So I need to sell those off and then I can order more and hopefully the demand will remain. It's gotten down to a pretty good science the way that they do these things now. And iUniverse, I researched for about 3 days on the internet, and it seemed like the best way to go out of all the people out there.
I interrupted when you were talking about Cartoon Eyes just because it was a question that I didn't want to get.
Oh, sure.
Didn't want to forget about the whole distribution. But to jump back to that, now that you've done one book and you're starting on your second, are you going to publish it, distribute it the same way?
Cartoon Eyes, because it's a young adult fantasy novel, it's an entirely different arena. And so I'm probably going to try again and market it to agents Whereas Darkening Road, for some reason, it seemed like they want vampire romance. They want Matrix clones and Harry Potter clones and something that's easily marketable, packageable, and ultimately probably made into a movie. And Cartoonized definitely has, it's got the stuff for that. It's sort of Enchanted in reverse. It's a little bit of Stay Tuned from the 80s. I think that one may have a better chance. And in fact, I almost think I should have written it first as a foot in the door sort of thing, but it wasn't where the passion was at that point. So,
and is that where the passion is now? Or?
Yeah, I'm really enjoying the heck out of writing Cartoon Eyes. The characters this time are not based on anyone, but they really feel very alive, and I guess they're just all aspects of me and my youth in various places, I suppose.
Any of them work in bookstores?
More interesting. No, not yet. I think they're all kind of between eighth grade and high school. So yeah, there is a little book thing in there, though I couldn't resist. Talking book.
How far along are you on it?
Six or seven, I think seven chapters now, and there's going to be about 10, so probably 70% of the way through the extremely rough draft. It's going to get a whole rewrite and cleaned up, and then my girlfriend is looking forward to this, I think. maybe not. I'm going to be watching lots and lots and lots of fantasy anime and studying backgrounds and dialogue and hairstyles and clothing and the way they talk. And so we're just going to fill up the Netflix queue with a ton of probably subpar anime because it's more fun to make fun of and I don't want to go after the good stuff, and imbue and put everything in there from that. So
are there going to be pictures?
I think so. I think. I don't see, if it's through iUniverse again, it may be pricey to do it that way. So I don't know. If I have a traditional publisher, then probably. I have a friend who does very cartoonish, kind of ElfQuest-ish fantasy art that lives up here in Nevada City, who I think would be fantastic to maybe do one picture per chapter, begin the chapter with a full-page picture, and he would be great. So I have to talk to him about that. I haven't reached it yet.
In Down the Darkening Road, I sort of expected there would be a map, and there wasn't. And I guess that was because of the cost.
Well, that and the fact that I can't draw maps. And I don't know. I have a map. I do have a map kind of pinned on the wall that I use for reference. So all the geography should be fairly correct, I hope. But yeah, I don't know. It never really. I hope in such a way because the pilgrimage travels in this relatively linear fashion, and they keep talking about their destinations. I don't think anybody's going to get lost. I hope.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Thome, and I've been talking for the last 20 minutes or so with James Van Eaton, who many people may know from having worked at Ames Bookstore in Grass Valley and now as one of the proprietors of Winston Smith Books in Auburn. We've been talking about his epic fantasy, epic fantasy Down the Darkening Road, which he has just brought out, and Cartoon Eyes, a more young adult book, which is somewhere down the works. And clearly, if these go anywhere, there's going to be many, many more after that.
Right. Like I said before, I don't think I can stop. Even if I start losing money, it's probably not going to matter. I'll just keep publishing as long as I can scrounge some up. So it's been fun. It will be fun.
Okay. Well, and it's been fun having you. So
thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
And before we make way for Jimmy Carty's Rock and Roll Party, one other organization that has come to my attention, and this again is a sort of self-published one, but of one of interest. I got a email from a woman named Molly Lindquist in Pennsylvania saying, hey, you ought to let people know about my website, Lit Lovers. And I looked it over, and it's a website. It's called a well-read online community, litlovers.com. It gives ideas for book clubs in particular or book groups, but it also has a whole bunch of what they are calling freshman-level English classes for people who never took those freshman-level English classes. You can do that all online. Some gifts and various other things that all fit in with people who may not be the most heavy-duty readers but want to enjoy doing it and want to do more of it. When I wrote back to Molly Lundquist to find out exactly how she'd found out about me, because I thought she's in Pennsylvania and she's just said she ran across Booktown somewhere. And when I said, Pennsylvania. Booktown's out here. She said, oh, come on. We're not that backward here, despite what James Carville said, which is Pennsylvania is Philadelphia and Pittsburgh with Alabama in between. She says he's right. But nonetheless, that's where she puts out Lit Lovers. And I think if you are a book group sort of person, this might be your sort of website, litlovers.com. This has been Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'm getting out of here because Jimmy Accardi only has about 2 minutes before he's going to start talking. So stay tuned for him. Thanks very much to James Van Eden and earlier in the day, Gail Green.